But I want you just to hear the Tibetan. It's a blessing to hear it. It helps you. A lot of people end up moving from this class to the Tibetan class. You do not have to learn Tibetan, okay? You probably will end up. But I just ask you to repeat it in Tibetan. It's good for you. It's a blessing. And then I'll explain it in English. So quiz, homework, everything else is in English. Don't worry about it. But it's good to know. It's good to hear it. Okay, so first say, Dunya.
Dunya.
Dunya. And don't be shy. When I ask you to say it back, just give it some okay? Dunya ge.
Dunya.
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 All right. Dunya means suffering. Dunya means
suffering.
Ki means of. Ki means of. This is the first of three different kinds of suffering that we have. Okay? It's the first of the three kinds of suffering that you and I have. It's called suffering of suffering. Suffering of suffering means outright suffering, obvious suffering. What's an example?
Suffering.
Yeah, in fact, that's what the scripture says. 2,500 years ago, apparently they have the same problem. It's a pain in your backache, all right? Or a headache. That's dunyakitunya. Or anxiety attack at work, anger, okay, upset, hurt someone in a relationship. Those are all suffering or suffering. So mental or physical. Okay, mental or physical suffering. Just straight, obvious suffering. Okay, outright suffering. We don't have it all day long, unless you have an illness or something, or unless you're very depressed. You don't get this all day long. You have it on and off. You know, you have your healthy days. Maybe once a month you get seriously ill. Then you get better, or everybody has some little illness somewhere in their body. You look normal, but you know. And everybody in this room probably has something. Okay. And then mentally we all know. We all have suffering throughout the day, on and off. We don't have it all day long.
That's what happens if people are terminally ill? They can't.
They have it all day long.
Okay. So, but would they be including this?
Yeah. Huh? That's the first kind of suffering. Say, Gyurwe.
Gyurwe.
Don't be wimpy now. Gyurwe?
Gyurwe.
Dunya.
Gyurwe?
Gyurwe. Dunya.
Okay.
Gyurwe means change. Dunya means what?
Suffering.
This little Y means of. By the way, Tibetan order and English order are opposite. So you read from the back. This is the suffering of change. Okay? The scriptures define as any kind of pleasure that you and I can have. Any impure kind of pleasure. Mental or physical. Any impure kind of pleasure. Impure means this. Any kind of pleasure that you and I can have always ends in a sour note. Any kind of pleasure that you or I can have always screws up at the end. Okay? I'll give examples, but you don't need them. I mean, anytime you have a career, the end of the career is either you get old and die, or they fire you, or whatever. But it always ends on a bad note. Okay? Always. Everybody. Okay? You have a relationship, either you get divorced or separated, or one of the partners dies. And that's the end of it. There is no other choice. There is no other end. It's always like that. Any pleasure you can count, okay? Your health, your own health, or if you are handsome or beautiful, you will lose it. Must lose it. You will lose it. You know, strong, handsome, beautiful, whatever. You will lose it. Attached to every pleasant thing we ever experience is a lousy ending. Okay? You cannot experience a pleasure in this life, in our present condition, that does not deteriorate at the end. So Buddhism says that ain't a pleasure, then that's not a real pleasure. If it must be attached to destruction or deterioration at the end, then you have to count it as suffering. Looks like nice. They call it honey on a razor blade, you know? Licking honey off a razor blade. And I mean, it tastes good for a few seconds. Then you feel the cut. Behind every honey pleasure that we can experience is pain. It's waiting behind the scenes. It will always come out at the end. We cannot experience anything else. If you have any pleasure now that seems to have been going on for a while, don't worry. it will end. It'll deteriorate, and it will bring you a lot of suffering when it does. That's the nature of armed life. That has a lot to do, everything to do with the cause of it. The cause of what, of your pleasure. The cause of having anything nice happen in this life. According to Buddhism, you can prove it, it takes a few courses. The older people went through that. It's your past deeds, it's your past karma. What you planted in your mind. That always wears out. The cause always wears out. You did a good deed, you're going to get some pleasure from it. You helped somebody, you were nice to somebody, you didn't get angry when you should have gotten angry. You did something good. As a result of that, in the future, you have some kind of pleasure, pleasant event, physical or mental. And then when that power runs out, when the power of that karma runs out, which actually runs out inside your own mind, you perceive that as suffering. It always ends up in a suffering. That's the nature of any kind of pleasure we can have. That's where those pleasures come from. And that's the end of all of them. Any decent thing that's happening in your life now has a bad ending attached to it. And that's the second kind of suffering. Suffering number three, last one. Say, kyaba.
Kyaba.
Dujegi.
Dujegi.
Dunya.
Dunya.
What's dunya mean?
That's
Key is up, and kyaba duce roughly means per se, pervasive. This is called pervasive suffering. Pervasive suffering means it covers everybody. Okay? There are realms in the universe which you and I cannot see, where beings are living a pretty pleasant existence, more pleasant than we do. You know, they're called like pleasure realms. You get there by being a very good person in one life. So they don't have backaches and things like that, but they do have pervasive suffering. Pervasive suffering means it spreads through all the realms. It doesn't matter whether you're on this planet or whether you're in another realm where beings are having a better time. They still must get old and die. The nature of their body, the nature of their whole existence, their whole being, is to get old and die. And that's the third kind of suffering. So it's called pervasive suffering, but what it refers to is the condition that you and I have, that we must get old and die, and that we are getting old every moment. Okay? This suffering begins at when the sperm of your father hits the egg of your mother. Okay? It begins at conception. Aging and dying starts at that moment. First moment of your life, you begin to age. That's the third kind of suffering. Yeah.
When you say it's first all the realms, does that mean the realm of the
gods? Does not. Yeah. Or in hell realms, but it does not mean a Buddha realm. Okay. I don't mean to say that. Okay. Those Buddhas are outside of this whole thing. They don't have any of these kinds of suffering. So when I say higher realm, I'm talking about there are certain kind of realms where there are certain kind of happy beings who are not like us. They live much longer than us. They don't have any big problems during their life. They have a good time their whole life, and then at the end they have great suffering, they die, and then they move down to a different... That's what pervasive means here. Pervasive means it covers all the realms. Any kind of life in the universe, unless it's enlightened, is suffering this way, getting old and dying.
Does everybody get to that realm? Do we have to go there? Is there a way to
theoretically,
go there?
We've been there trillions and countless times. We have been there.
How do you stop that?
Huh?
How do you stop that?
Reach enlightenment.
This one, the other one.
How to get out of that realm?
Right, where everything happens very slow. And, you know,
they just have to go through it. Anything. You go through it and you reach the end and you die. Then you come down to the lower realm.
How do you get there?
You reach there by being extremely good in this life. And it's considered a kind of suffering because they also get old and die. It's not a desirable place.
Is there anything to learn there?
No. They say it's better to be a human because they have a good mix of suffering and pleasure.
So we don't want to be good because then we end up...
Not that kind of good. We want to be good and reach Buddha. And Nirvana. Seriously. It's true that we don't want to be good in the sense to go to that place and waste time. That's true.
What kind of good do you do in order to get there?
Mainly meditation. Deep stages of unthinking meditation. It's one of the problems of bad meditation.
Right. That I got it.
When you're in deep meditation, you can't do anything wrong. Okay. All right. Those are the three kinds of suffering. They say that every experience that you and I have, if you cover all the sufferings that you have and all the pleasures that you have, physical and mental, that covers everything. What it means is that everything about your life is suffering. You don't have any other kind of experience. The suffering is suffering, and the pleasure is suffering too. Okay? All the good things that happen to you are lousy because they're always attached to a lousy end. And no one would argue that the honey on a razor blade is a good thing. It cuts your mouth. Yeah?
Not everything has to have its bad ending. That's just a,
example.
Well, I could go through a change and just have acceptance of it, and I don't have to react so that it's a bad ending.
We had this debate in California about two months ago. We had a big question during the class. Is the goal of Buddhism to reach a state of equanimity, where you can put up with any kind of crap that happens to you in life? Is that the goal? Because a lot of people, if you really question them, and in the end, just can somebody answer the door? Banzai, can you check the door? Just check and see if there's anyone there. Is that the goal of Buddhism? You know, is it to reach a state of, is that the state where you're total equanimity, and whatever bad things happens to you in this life, you can accept it, you can have some kind of embracing of it, and not get upset, and turn it into sort of a good thing, and sort of absorb it in a kung fu way. Is that the goal of Buddhism? And I was in a class of 20-year students. These were people who had been studying for 20 years. And I said, is that the goal? And we really discussed it seriously. We really had a good discussion, and people weren't really sure. They talked about it, and we fleshed it out. It's not the goal. I mean, the goal is to reach a realm or a place. It's not where you put up with bad things, but where they don't even occur. You stop the causes for suffering. That's the Four Noble Truths. That was the first thing the Buddha taught. The holiday was Thursday night. Was it? Monday night. Last Monday night. That was the anniversary of him teaching 2,500 years ago. And he said, the goal of Buddhist practice is not to put up with a lousy life. It's to remove the lousy life. To reach a higher kind of life, a higher kind of existence. And so that's a common question that people have, you know. It seems like, from all the pictures you've seen, that it's Buddhist masters putting up with lousy existence with some kind of equanimity. It's much more radical than that. If you practice Buddhism properly, you actually change reality. Reality changes in life. That's the goal. You can reach a place that doesn't have any of those three. And that's the goal. As long as a place has those three, I'm not interested in it. I don't want to be there. Yeah.
Michael, that sounds like the ultimate goal, but isn't it an absolutely necessary intermediate goal to not respond to bad things that are happening to you, to employ equanimity so that you do not perpetuate bad karma?
If you practice well, you'll see that equanimity happens to be the best way to get to the ultimate goal. It's a side effect. It makes life more bearable. But ultimately, the goal is to get to a place where you don't have to be patient with life. Life is just good. Okay, so like that. Alright. And that's a Buddhist paradox. So those are the three sufferings. You could map out your life like this. Actually, it goes on like that. And you could say life is going in a timeline, okay? And this is the life that you've lived up to now. Okay, this line is tonight. This line here. And all the life you've lived up to now is gone. And you've had suffering, or you've had certain kinds of pleasures or pains or whatever. They don't count for anything tonight. They might be at best a good memory or a bad memory. But anyway, you're still alive. They didn't kill you. They might have been happy or whatever, but they're all finished anyway. They might as well be a dream that you just woke up from. They don't have any effect on you now. They're gone. That part of your life is gone. You have a section here up until the time that you die. And this is death. And you have a section here. You're moving through this timeline uncontrollably. You don't have a choice. You can't slow things down. Life is propelling you at a certain speed. You cannot affect it. You cannot say, I'd like to slow down for a while. You can't say, I'd like to get older a little slower. Okay? It is uncontrollably, it's like a huge, powerful river, and it's carrying you. You're out of control. It's carrying you to this date that you've died. You have no control over it. And you're hopeless. You're helpless in the sense that you're just being driven towards that death, and you've got, we don't know how long it is. It could be stopping tonight. We don't know. But you're just being thrust towards that death, and you have no control over it. You might as well be a feather in a tornado. And you're being thrown around. You're being controlled by past events. You don't have any big choice about it. You can decide to get a new job or change your hairstyle or whatever. But basically, you cannot change the thrust of you into oblivion. Okay? You can't even slow it down. You can't take a day off. You don't get a rest. It's just thrusting you at a certain velocity, and it's out of control. We have no control over it. We're hopeless. We're helpless. We are being controlled by those events, and we're being thrust towards death at a certain speed. And we're all in the same condition. You die, and then, according to what we've learned in other courses, which, you know, if you weren't in them, it's okay. The mind goes on. I'm not going to go through all the proofs that the mind goes on. But I've noticed that if I put it this way, it's a lot easier for me. You can't prove to me that the mind does not go on. Okay? You have the very flimsy argument that the body stops twitching. Okay? It doesn't prove a thing about the mind. The mind is totally different material from the body. The mind is invisible. The mind cannot be touched. The mind cannot be divided. The mind cannot be burned. You can put an atomic bomb next to the mind. You can blow it off. You have no proof that the mind was affected at all. Okay. The mind is different material from the body. Okay. The mind is ineffable. The mind can go to your apartment right now and check the door. See if the stove's on. The mind is not restricted to the skin. The mind goes beyond the skin. The mind is different. The mind is indestructible. You cannot destroy the mind. The mind has been there forever. It's going to go on forever. I propose that. You don't have to accept it. You absolutely can't prove to me anything else. You can't prove to me anything about the mind dying when your body dies. Maybe the car is broken and the driver's inside cursing the car. It won't go anymore. But you can't prove to me that it's not true. It happens to be true, which is why you can't prove it to me. But that's another subject, okay?
Is it all powerful?
No. Not even the Buddha. So the mind is going to go on. All right? That mind goes on in the same sort of uncontrollable rush. Whatever thoughts you had in this life, all those milliseconds of thought, was it 64 thoughts in the time I can snap my fingers. Millithoughts. Okay, milliseconds of thought. They continue. They all affect your mind. You go through the process of death. The process of the body dissolving on which the mind rests upsets the mind. The mind starts to hallucinate. And when you cross this line, the mind is also out of control. You can't think straight anymore. You start to have terrible hallucinations. You actually become a totally different being. You wouldn't recognize yourself anymore, and you won't recognize yourself anymore, and you have no control over it. You could be a horribly different kind of existence 30 seconds after you die. Totally different. No thing about what you're experiencing now is there. Totally different and bizarre and horrible experiences. It's possible. Okay? So basically, you and I have that to look forward to. Up until the point of death, we have those three sufferings to enjoy. After the point of death, when the mind is totally disrupted by the destruction of the body, we start to have a totally different world around us. Totally unrecognizable. Very frightening. It's possible. I mean, normal. That's about all we have to look forward to. That's our life. That's your life. If I say meditate on the two kinds of suffering, not three, okay? two. You've got the three kinds of suffering to look forward to in this life. And then after that big moment, a mind which is very, very frightened and undergoing very frightening experiences. And totally unimaginable now. I mean, Freddy the 13th and all that is not even close. Horrible things, probably, most people, because of their lack of training. What I mean is, if you don't learn what to do, and you don't learn the right things to do, your mind will go through that. And 99.999% of humanity is in that condition. They are being thrust towards this death, hopelessly, helplessly, not even aware. I mean, most people aren't even thinking about it. They're being rushed on the subway, you know. They're thrown in this cattle car and they're being rushed to death. And they're not even aware. I mean, they're just like ignorant. Bliss. Ignorance is bliss, right? Better not to know, I guess. It's their condition. They're distracted by, are they happy? Do they have a good house? Are the people at work treating them right? Do they have the right partner? Are the children growing up nice? They're distracted by all these questions, but all that time they're being rushed off the cliff, and then they fall off the cliff. And they're totally unaware. They're totally like sheep being led to the slaughter, and they have no... The day comes, they get slaughtered, and the whole existence changes. There's no kids anymore, there's no husband, there's no job, there's no person they didn't like or person they did like. They're in a totally different realm. Things are going on which are horrifying, and they don't even remember what they were before. And that's all that a normal person has to look forward to. They're not aware what's happening, and when it happens, the last thing they could do is to do anything about it. They don't know what to do. They have no training, no warning, and that's our condition. It's the condition of every person in this room and everyone you meet on the subway and everybody you see in the street. It's all of our condition. We're either suffering now, or after we die, it's going to be worse. So, and that, there's only two places to go. Either be alive now and have those three sufferings, or die and have worse. And there's only two destinations for most people in humanity. It's a very frightening thing, and it's a very sad thing. And that's our condition. That's life. Yeah?
Is there a specific name for that state of mind after death that you said was that?
Yeah, it is called Nengaki Dunya, which means Nengat means it's very hard to translate, like vital point suffering. And you have this kind of special suffering that you never had in this life. It's the suffering of the moment of death. It's the suffering of your life force ending, like stabbed to the heart. The word means something like that.
Physical.
Yeah, and mental. And it's a very special kind of suffering. It's some kind of, it's the last scream you hear on the black box in the airplane. You know, it's of a person who knows that they're dying. And it's some kind of special.
So it's that suffering. Moment, that suffering, as opposed to that state that you then wind up in.
That's the beginning of that state. So we only have those two places to go. We're either alive, and we're going through three sufferings, nothing else, no other experience. Everything we experience is in one of those three categories. Or we're dead, and we're worse. And that's the only thing we have to look forward to.
Death untrained.
To an untrained person.
So you're talking about all of
them. Yeah, and then the next life.
Yeah, it's all projection.
Ultimately, yeah. The death.
In English?
What?
Break that down?
Which
the suffering of the moment?
I'd rather look it up for you. I'm not quite sure how to spell it. Nay is this. But that's our condition. Now, that's when you realize that, that's renunciation. You hear Buddhists are supposed to have renunciation. So you think it means that if you're going to be a good Buddhist, you can't enjoy a good dinner anymore, you can't go to good movies anymore, you can't listen to music. It's not like that. Okay? Renunciation means what the feeling you just had about 2 minutes ago when you said, yeah, what he said is true. That's renunciation. You will naturally give up certain things, and you will naturally want to study if you understand what's happening. You know, and it's not like you're going to have to force yourself to give them up. It doesn't mean you have to give up things. The state we are seeking is similar to the happinesses we have in this life. In other words, just be like a normal rat in a cage that goes away from the electrical shock and goes towards the food. You know? I mean, just give up the things that deserve to be given up and seek the things which deserve to be sought. Just try to avoid pain and try to reach some kind of happiness. That's renunciation. It's very difficult to reach, and it's very natural to reach. It's not wanting a lousy life and wanting to get somewhere where it doesn't work that way. Wanting to reach a state which doesn't have AIDS and Bosnia and cancer and atomic weapons and pollution. You know what I mean? It's a natural desire to get away from bad things and reach good things. Yeah.
Yes, I was going to ask you, these sufferings are co-created, right? They're just simply, the sufferings are there because we created them.
Where they come from?
Are they like thought forms?
You have to study emptiness.
Is it true that most of the suffering that we go through now is suffering that we create by our minds? So the idea is to clear everything. The idea is to be clear and see things the way they are.
Well, I distinguish between this. A psychological removal of your suffering and an actual removal of your suffering. So what it means is, to reach a state in this life where someone could come to you and poke you with a knife and you wouldn't feel it and you wouldn't mind it and you'd still smile, it doesn't mean that. It means to reach a place where there is no one in the world who would want to poke you with a knife. It means to reach a different realm altogether.
A spiritual realm, not a physical.
It's a realm. It will have spiritual qualities also. When you reach there, there will be certain beautiful qualities of that world. You know, the ground doesn't have any rocks on it. It feels like a cushion. And everyone you meet is a highly advanced spiritual person. And anytime someone's in trouble on any planet in this galaxy, you're there automatically to help them. Those are the qualities of a Buddha. That's what you want to reach. But is it to reach a state where you can put up with the crap in this life? No. No, you'd be in a crapless world. A lot of people confuse that point. As a byproduct, until you get there, you will be the kind of person, or you can reach the kind of state where someone stabs you, you can love them. You will have to reach that state. But that's not where you're headed. That's not the goal. It's a byproduct of what you're reaching. So, renunciation is just understanding the condition we're in. You can't debate with anything I said tonight. You can't point to me a relationship that where one of the partners doesn't die. You can't point to me a family that didn't disintegrate. You can't point to me a career that lasted forever. You can't point to me a house that didn't fall down after it was built. You can't point to me a beautiful or healthy or strong person who didn't get old and ugly and wrinkled and diseased. There's no debate. It's our nature. That's renunciation. Renunciation is very clear, considering the possibilities of a life that's not like that. Totally different kind of existence, realm. And you can reach it, and you can do it. And you just become a good educated Buddhist, follow the practices, and you reach it. And that's what I like about Buddhism. You just do this, do this, do this, do this, and you get there. And you can check it out, because you can try it for a year, or you can try it for 6 months, and if you do it nicely, you'll start to get some kind of result. And that's all. That's renunciation. Tonight we're talking about bodhicitta. Bodhi means Buddhahood. Citta means wish for. The wish for Buddhahood, the wish for enlightenment. Bodhicitta means the wish for enlightenment. Sometimes it's badly translated as Bodhi mind, and then you think it means a Buddha's mind, and it doesn't mean that. It's something that we can have now. It's the wish that we could reach Buddhahood. It's the wish that you and I could reach enlightenment for the sake of other people. What it means is, if you take that renunciation, which is simply the recognition of your own problem, that you only got two places to go, and you turn it around to other people, like you look in this room at the other people in this room, everyone's in the same condition. Unless I am some kind of emanation of some tantric deity, I'm in the same boat as you. I have the same problems as you. I also am being I'm hurtling towards this, and the moment that happens, I'm at the mercy of certain uncontrollable conditions. I'm in as much trouble as you are. Your mother is, your wife is, your kids are, your aunt is, President Clinton is, someone who just got shot in Sarajevo is. We're all in the same condition. We all have that same condition. We are all in one of two conditions, suffering now or terrified later. Everybody. It doesn't matter how powerful somebody looks or how healthy or how pretty or how successful. You know, wait a few weeks or years. It'll become obvious. They'll get there too, obviously. I mean, they're there now. It'll become obvious. We're all in the same condition. We're all suffering the same. Every person you meet is in the same condition. Everyone else you meet outside, they don't have any training. I don't need to say in Buddhism, but in dying or in spiritual life, they're not only suffering, but they have no hope. It's hopeless. They don't admit the situation. The day that they do, they're too old to do anything about it. It's too late to study. They don't know anything what to do when death comes. They have no clue, no inkling, no training at all. Their condition is desperate. It's extremely dangerous and desperate. And they have no possible relief. They're gonna suffer, and they have no idea of the method to get out of it. And that's the condition of the people around us. Bodhicitta is saying, I wish I could help them. You know, I wish I could somehow affect other people and help them. You can't really help them unless you reach the goal yourself. You know that kind of BS where someone's teaching something and they haven't reached the thing. Like me. You can't really help somebody else if you really haven't experienced that thing yourself. You can describe what other people said about it. You can say what the books say. You can say what you heard in a lecture. But it's nothing like something you actually know from your own experience. You reach that thing yourself, and you're trying to help someone else reach it. Bodhicitta means that. Bodhicitta means you and I would like to become enlightened so we could really help other people reach that. And that's what we're going to study. Bodhicitta is the wish. It comes first. We call it the prayer. That's the first kind of bodhicitta. And maybe you got a taste of it just now. And maybe you got just an inkling of it just now. You know, how nice it would be if because of this class and because of some training you undergo and some meditation that you do, you reach some really high level and you can help other people get out of that, this torrent, you know, this river that they're thrown into. How nice it would be if you could help them. That's the prayer. If you get any kind of inkling for that tonight, from what I said, you know, that everyone else around you, all the people you love, all the people you're close to, their condition is totally desperate. Their condition is very, very dangerous. If they die like that, and you can't reach them anymore, you can't contact them anymore, they're going to undergo tremendous suffering. You know, so you kind of feel some kind of urge to try to help them. That's the bodhicitta, the wish in the form of a prayer. There's a second kind of bodhicitta. That's where you want to do something about it. One is you decide in the class, okay, yeah, I wouldn't like to see my brother or my wife or my child just get thrown into death like that, hopelessly, untrained, nothing that can help them. I would like to learn something that I can pass on to them where they could be protected. They could reach some place of safety from that. I would like to do that. Number two is, okay, goddammit, I'm going to do it. You know, it's a decision. I will do something. You know, I'm going to do something about it. You know, that's some kind of different mental state. This state is like saying, man, I wish I could do it. And number two is, okay, what do I have to do? Tell me what I have to do. Right? Basically, you have to do two things. One, you have to take the vows. Bodhisattva vows. You have to learn them, then you have to take them. You don't have to take the Bodhisattva vows if you're in this class, okay? You don't have to be a Buddhist to be in this class. I don't care. I'm going to teach you the Bodhisattva vows. They're the only vows you can study before you take them. And we will. You're welcome to take them if you want to take them later on. You'll have an opportunity. You don't have to take them if you don't want to. don't have to be a Buddhist if you don't want, I don't care. But you can learn the Bodhisattva vows. Whether or not you take them, they're wonderful vows. They're a wonderful way of life. The Bodhisattva vows are a code of life that helps everyone around you and helps you. It's a beautiful code of life. And that's the first thing you do when you decide to take the wish. The second thing you do is you study the six perfections. There are six Bodhisattva activities that you do. We're not going to study those in this course. We're going to spend 6 weeks just on the Bodhisattva vows. Bodhisattva vows are a code of life. It's very, very beautiful. It's nice to know them. It's nice to practice them. You can start doing them at work the next day. And very useful. It makes your life happy whether or not you believe everything else about death and rebirth and everything. If you only just practice them and never do anything else, never go to a Buddhist class, never call yourself a Buddhist, it doesn't matter. They're beautiful. They make your life much happier. And hopefully they make your whole future happy. You cannot reach enlightenment without taking those vows and keeping those vows. So we're going to go through those vows. We'll take a break now. Come back in about 10 minutes. You're welcome to come over there. It's up the stairs and across here. And there's some refreshments there and stuff like that. When we come back, we'll talk about where the vows came from. Say, Simke.
Simke.
Pani.
Pani.
Shindinchir.
Shindinchir.
Yanda.
Yanda.
Zope.
Zope.
Changchu.
Changchu.
Du.
Du.
That's the definition of bodhicitta. Buddhism loves definitions. So that even if something goes on for 2,500 years, people are still defining it the same way. And it doesn't get updated by the new age people of each generation, okay? This is the definition given by Maitreya. Maitreya is the future Buddha. And according to the highest teachings of Buddhism, he's already a Buddha. And this is his definition of bodhicitta. It's given in the Abhisamaya Alankara, which is a book that he dictated to Sankhya. Okay. So, Semke Pani. Semke Pa means bodhicitta. The ni means is. Tibetan, where do we have to start?
The
back. We go to the back. The wish. The wish. De means the wish. Bodhicitta is the wish to reach Yanda Dzogpe Changchu. Yanda Dzogpe Changchu means pure and total enlightenment. Pure and total enlightenment. I used to get confused by this. I thought, if it's enlightenment, it's enlightenment, you know? Is there an impure enlightenment? But there is lesser enlightenment. It's a long story. This means total enlightenment. Pure, total enlightenment. So what we have so far is, bodhicitta is the wish to reach pure, total enlightenment. Shendinchir. Shendinchir means for the sake of other people. For the sake of other beings, actually. Bodhicitta is the wish to reach pure and total enlightenment for the sake of other beings. This is where you're focusing on enlightenment, and you're doing it for all those people around you whose condition is desperate. It's hopeless. It'd be better if everybody in New York had HIV or something, and then you would really believe it. You know, if everybody on the subway had a cane and splotches all over them, and you would get that emotion if you were the only healthy person. That's what the situation is. The situation is worse than that. Their situation is more desperate than that. The suffering that they are headed for, and the suffering they're in now, is hopeless. And bodhicitta means to have some sort of pity for their condition. Do something. Yeah.
Why do you have to be totally enlightened to help other people?
They say you can help. You can pass it on. Obviously, you can be of some assistance. A sangha was not a Buddha. Sangha was the third level bodhisattva. It obviously you don't have to be a total Buddha to be of the service to other people. But the difference in the capacity of a Buddha to help an enlightened person, if I'm enlightened, I can see in one glance your whole future for thousands of years. Your whole past for thousands of years. I see every corner of your mind. I know precisely what sentence to say that will help you avoid that suffering at any given moment. I know precisely what you personally need to hear at this moment to get there quicker. And nobody else has that capacity. No other being has that capacity. So they try to reach that. Yes?
You don't need many lifetimes to reach total enlightenment.
Normally, it takes three periods consisting of 69 to 71 countless eons. Countless is a word that means 10 to the 16th power.
So, very nice.
Normally, it takes trillions of years.
Wow.
If you practice bodhisattva vows, and if you are trained properly in tantra, you can achieve it in this life.
So it is possible.
Yeah.
And if everybody's in this room, then it
has something. It has everything to do with it. Yeah.
Does it mean we have no choice?
You actually don't have any choice. You really don't have any choice. You might as well do it now. If you don't do it now, you have to do it later anyway. You're going to be back in this class eventually. You don't have any choice. You really, I mean, I don't like to put it that way, but you are suffering. You don't come back, if you don't do it now, you're going to come back and do it some other time. You're going to have to, you might as well just finish it now. And you must do it for other people. You can try to be selfish, you can try to get some meditation, or you can try to reach some great levels on your own and ignore the condition of the people around you. But you cannot reach Buddhahood that way. And ultimately, you'll have to take care of other people. You might as well do it now. You might as well start now. Yeah? I said all other people and I corrected myself to all other beings. It means all other living beings. All living kind. Okay? Shen means others. And others means all other living beings. For the sake of one.
Just something for the sake?
For the sake of is the cheer. I mean, if you really want to know. For the benefit of, for the sake of, for the good of. I'd like to see if I gave you everything on the homework, because otherwise I get 50 phone calls. If I ask you what's the relationship between renunciation and bodhicitta, you should probably say bodhicitta is renunciation aimed at other people. Every good thing that's going on in our lives is doomed. We might as well get out of it and find something. If we recognized it for what it was, we wouldn't be attached to it. So it's not like I'm begging you to give up ice cream. Just try to find ice cream that doesn't make you fat. You know, reach some or give you cavities, you know. Find a happiness that's not attached to a suffering. You will naturally seek it in your life. Do it now and do it intelligently. Do it before you get too old to do it. You've got to be healthy to do these things. To practice tantra, you have to be in good physical condition. You have to. There are a lot of things you have to do. You can't wait until you get too old. We have a window of opportunity. Yeah?
Is that the meditation you just said? What you just referred to now? Why did you?
I forgot what I talked to you about. She said something about. Yeah. Renunciation and bodhicitta.
That part I know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway. Now.
About finding the happiness of living for suffering.
And there was a. There is a question on. The last question of the homework is something you will get from the reading. I'm going to leave it. And you have to read the reading well. And you'll be able to answer the last question. Jetsu Kapa compares our condition to a person who is handcuffed, put into an iron cage, and that cage is thrown into a Niagara Falls, okay? And it's nighttime. There's nobody else around, okay? And each one of those has a different meaning. It represents that timeline that I drew. That's our condition. We might as well be that person. We have as much hope as that person. If we don't do something, now, if we don't meditate, if we don't practice properly, we might as well be like that. Our condition is very similar. Okay, we have about 10, 15 minutes. I'm going to just, that's the real heart of, I mean, the purpose tonight was to talk about what is bodhicitta. Because based on bodhicitta, you take the bodhisattva vow. You say, okay, I believe what you said. I do want to help other people. then I tell you, you have to understand the bodhisattva class. You must take the bodhisattva class. You must study what they are, then you must keep them. I don't say that everyone in this class has to take. It's not a requirement of the class to take the bodhisattva class. If you want to get enlightened, you have to take it. If you don't do it now, you have to do it later. I'm not proselytizing for bodhisattva. It's nice to know them. It's nice to live by them. Whatever you do with them, right? It's not my business. If you eventually want to take them, certainly I'll make sure you can. But the purpose is to study that code of life, which would lead you to be capable to help all the beings around you who are suffering like that. And that's the purpose of the bodhisattva. Where do they come from? And so I'm going to do just like 10 minutes of technical stuff, dry stuff, all right? That's the worst thing at the end of class, if everybody falls asleep. But it's on your homework, so you got to listen. I'm going to tell you where the vowels come from. I think it's nice to know. I think Western people like to know. In the monastery, when we study these things, they don't even tell us who wrote the book. You know, we got to memorize the book. It takes us 3 years. We don't know who wrote it. You know, they said, don't worry about it. Just memorize it. You know? I think Westerners, we like to know where things came from. We're going to be studying a book called Shunlong.
Michael, is this where they come from, or is this about where they come from?
I'll go through it. I'll explain it. Say Changchu.
Changchu.
Shunlam.
Shunlam.
Changchu.
Changchu.
Shunlam.
Shunlam.
This book, Changchu means, do you know?
Bodhi.
It's the Bodhi in Bodhisattva. It means Bodhi. It's short for Bodhisattva. Bodhisattva is any person who gets that wish truly in their heart. Any person, doesn't matter if you're Buddhist or what, doesn't really matter. Any person who decides that they would like to become totally enlightened to help other people, then you're a bodhisattva. You're already a bodhisattva. And you can practice to be a bodhisattva before you're a bodhisattva. Take the bodhisattva vows before you become a bodhisattva. Shunlam means highway. Highway. Shung means central. Lam means path. And it's the Tibetan word for a highway. Bodhisattva highway. The book is called Highway for Bodhisattvas. This is the main book we're going to study about the Bodhisattva vows. It's not where they came from. It's the best explanation of them. It was written by Jetsun Kapa. Jetsun Kapa is the greatest master ever to live in Tibet, greatest writer, Shakespeare of Tibet, greatest organizer, George Washington of Tibet, greatest founder of great monasteries in Tibet, greatest everything, Jetsun Kapa. Huh? The dates are what? Do you remember?
1347.
Nice. This is the boring part, okay? But I think it's nice to know. It's not nice. My teacher told me it was nice to know. I ignored him. When I was in India, I was in a train station. I saw a big commotion. I went to see what it was about. There was the senior tutor of the Dalai Lama, Ling Rinpoche. My teacher dragged me over there. He says to me in Tibetan, "What are you studying?" I said, "I forgot the name of the book." And my teacher was all red. And he was behind me. He's like, "Oh." You don't want to be like that, okay? That's Jetsun Kapa. This book is very difficult. It's very hard to read. It's never been translated. We're going to study the difficult points from that. It's considered one of his greatest writings. It's put in the first volume of his writings. He wrote 10,000 pages. That's one of the first books. In other words, it's one of the most important books. Never been translated by anybody. And we'll be studying that. There's a much easier version.
Which is that it's a commentary, Michael?
It's an explanation of the vows. It explains the difficult points of each one of the vows. Say, Norbu.
Norbu.
Norbu. Norbu. I think you might know Norbu. Do you know Norbu? It means jewel. Dalai Lama's brother was named Professor Norbu. Norbu means jewel. Wu means light. Like clear light is wisdom. Wu means light. Sunlight. Light. Cheng means a string, like a rosary is a Chengwa, but it means a string of anything. It means a big string of shining jewels. So you can imagine a rosary made of jewels that are shining with light. And that's an explanation of all the vows. There are monks' vows, only sattva vows and then tantric vows, secret vows. It explains all three. The explanation of the bodhisattva vows is brief and accurate and complete. So that's what you're going to end up with by the end of class. You're going to have the whole explanation of each vow. If you use Tsongkhapa's book, it would be like a couple hundred pages long. It's going to be about 40, 50 pages.
Right.
But it's good for you to have to take home and practice for the rest of your life. It gives you the vow, gives you a short description of the vow, tells you what the vow isn't, tells you what it is, tells you what to do. We have this book, which, by the way, this book is recommended by Pabonka, for those of you who know who he is. He never wrote a book about the vows because he said that's the only one you need. It was written by the teacher of the 10th Dalai Lama. It's very hard to get. We succeeded in getting it due to two of the students in this class. Ariel Holzworth, right? And Laura Siegel. And they went and combed these libraries and found these manuscripts, and we pieced it together. They did a nice job. She was faxing it all over the world. I have one more page we need. I'll give you the man's name who wrote it. These are not his dates. Okay? These are not his dates. These are the dates of the 10th Dalai Lama. He was the teacher of the 10th Dalai Lama. So we know he was alive during that time. We don't know his dates. 10th Dalai Lama, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th Dalai Lamas all died at age 20. Why? At age 21, they take power.
What? What do you mean they take power?
At age 21, they become the head of the country.
Oh, political power, you mean?
Yeah.
To
double
poison?
They die of natural causes?
No. We believe they were poisoned by the Chinese representative, but we don't know for sure. But they were guarded by the Chinese Manchurian troops, and they tended to die, you know, a month before. It was a way to keep the power of the country out of their hands. So he was the teacher of the 10th Dalai Lama. 10th Dalai Lama didn't move very well. We don't, by the way, I don't know for sure about that, but that's what the general belief is. I don't think we'll ever know for sure.
Did you say we were studying both these books or one?
We're going to study the fine points from Tsongkhapa's text. Whenever there's a difficult vow, and you say, well, what if I do that? And we'll say, we'll check Tsongkhapa. But Geshe Tsewang Sandrup's book is the one you want to have in your hand for the rest of your life to check your vows every day. You say, did I keep my vows? For those of you who are doing Tundruk, the practice of Tundruk is 99% to review your vows every day, six times a day, to see if you broke them. And you have to know them. So it's great to have a short explanation of each vow. And that's the function of Geshe Tsewang Sandrup's text. So you're going to have that. You'll have the Tibetan and the English book to keep. And then you know the vow very well. Lots of people take these vows. Very few people know what they are, and fewer people keep them. All right. Where did the vows come from? Last point. Sutra means any book taught by an enlightened being. It also means any book taught by an enlightened being which is not secret. If the book taught by the enlightened being is secret, it's not called a sutra, it's called a
tantra.
Okay. So sutra means an open teaching by an enlightened being. So who wrote this book? The Buddha. Okay. This is the original source of the Bodhisattva vows. Okay. You will find all the Bodhisattva vows in the sutras on the perfection of wisdom that the Buddha taught. Which book are they in? They're spread out all over. They happen to be concentrated in two of the books. And this is one of them. This sutra, this teaching by the Buddha, contains 13. You can find 13 of the root vows in this sutra. Is that a 2L?
Yes.
Okay. This sutra, which is another teaching by Lord Buddha, 2,500 years ago, it has one root vow. Okay. For those of you who care, this is the Bodhisattva Bhumi. You know who wrote it? Date?
1350. Yes, we.
Half brother?
Vasubandhu.
What Vasubandhu, right?
Abhidharma.
Abhidharma. We don't even know that. All the Abhidharma we ever get is taught by his brother. And Sangha wrote most of the Svatantrika texts we have. So, he wrote a book called Bodhisattva Levels. It has a very long chapter on morality. And in that chapter, it clarifies four root vows. They all come from the Perfection Wisdom Sutras. But if you go try to find them, you've probably got to have a computer. Spread out all over.
So are these four included in the 13?
No. How many we got?
18.
That's the total number of root vows. Those are the root bodhisattva vows are 18. And we'll study them. We'll go through them. But that's where they came from. Ultimately, they all came from the Prajnaparamita, Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. This is called Laptu. It's a very famous book. What was his most famous book?
Guide to the Bodhisattva's
Way of Life. Most famous. It's what His Holiness teaches everywhere he goes. We will have a course on it, or two or three. Fantastic book. Incredible book. He's a great master, 8th century. Master Shantideva. He took all 18 and put them in one place. Last thing, finished on time. This is the classic source for the 46 secondary vows. So how many total vows for Bodhisattvas? 64. And that's it. That's a nice class. I just want to say the vows are... When I say vows, you know, you think of monk's vows as something. Very restrictive, a big hassle to keep, no fun. You know, can't get drunk, can't look at girls, can't go to movies anymore, can't play music. Not like that. Bodhisattva vows are totally different. Bodhisattva vows are liberating. They're very beautiful. They're a very excellent code of life. And they're not like you're going to feel like restricted. But after you know these vows, and after you try them out in your daily life, you'll find that they make you very happy, and they make the whole atmosphere around you very pleasant. Aside from making you escape the suffering, which is their real benefit, they lead to a great kind of peace in your own life. So they're really not vows in the sense of, oh, you can't do that, you can't do that, you know, you gotta stay like that. It's not like that. They are ways of behavior which will make you much happier. And if you just try them for a while, you know, a couple of weeks or something, you'll notice radical changes in your life. Very beautiful changes. So those are the benefits of those vows. That's all. We'll do a prayer to close. I didn't go through the list of days that we will have no classes. That's the first thing in your notebook. So be sure to look at those. Make sure you don't come on those days.
Can you make sure we get everybody's name and number before they go?
Yeah, did you get everyone's? Did you get a list of everyone's?
No. Then if who has the mailing list?
Yeah, I do. We don't have a complete syllabus. We only have half of it.
The people who did the books left out.